This is Jared O'Brien for the Christians Engaging Culture podcast. Christians Engaging Culture exists to equip Christians to give faithful answers in everyday cultural conversations and to turn those conversations to the gospel. Well, last week we finished our series on getting a world that doesn't get it. For the next few episodes, we're going to include a few resources that we've spotted over the last little while that we think will be helpful for CEC listeners. Today we're listening to one of John Anderson's conversations, this time with Greg Lukianoff, co-author of The Coddling of the American Mind. They cover a lot of topics from the changing practices of parents to the restrictions of free speech on university campuses to wokeness in modern culture. We hope you find it helpful.
Today I'm joined by Greg Lukianoff. He's a lawyer, having graduated from American University and from Stanford. Greg is now the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE, and he's indeed wearing a t-shirt reflecting that today. He focuses on the First Amendment, constitutional law, and indeed on the predicament of freedom of expression on university campuses, a widely discussed and very important topic right across Western countries at the moment. In 2015, he wrote a now famous article with Jonathan Haidt called The Coddling of the American Mind. It was later turned into a very successful book. I've had the opportunity, listeners will remember, to talk to Jonathan directly about that. But since then, he's continued his writing, his speaking, and his activism on these issues. He's a frequent guest on TV, on radio, and now podcasts like this one. He's been published in numerous well-renowned places, including The Huffington Post, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, The New York Times, New Angeles Times, and Time Magazine. Quite an eclectic collection. Greg, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. I join you from Washington, D.C.
And it's cold there, and where I am, it's the middle of summer, so it's hot. But seasons are a great thing to enjoy.
Freezing rain.
Far cry from what we're enjoying here. But in 2015, you wrote a remarkable book, The Coddling of the American Mind. It became one of the most discussed articles and set of arguments of that year. In essence, can you just overview, what did you argue in that article and subsequent book? Why do you think it struck such a nerve, became such a talking point?
Well, I think it's because we noticed a real trend that other people were noticing, and partially because I started at FIRE in 2001. I'm a First Amendment trained constitutional lawyer. I defend free speech. That's one of the parts of the First Amendment. And I'd been defending this on college campuses since 2001. And it had always been the case that the students were actually good on free speech. The professors were questionable sometimes, and the administrators were generally really the problem. But that experience of being on the ground, you got to see all these little micro culture war trends come up time and time again. Like one day it would be something related to gun control. The next time it would be something related to Christianity or LGBT. So there are all these trends, but throughout all of them, the students were pretty good on speech. And then in 2013, late 2013, more like 2014, you just saw a really dramatic shift in the attitudes of the students themselves. And they weren't just requesting new speech codes, which was unusual, or disinvitations, which was get this, you know, in some cases, right winger, oftentimes also fellow left winger off my campus because I disagree with this one thing. They were couching it in the language of mental health and in sort of a medical justification for banning speech, which was not entirely new, but largely new to us. So, and if particularly if you're on the ground, it wasn't subtle. It wasn't as if there was this gradual shift in student attitudes. It was, there was 2013, 2014, and before. So that's when I went and talked to Jonathan Haidt, who I'd only recently become friends with, about my concern that essentially it seemed like we were teaching a generation of students the habits of anxious and depressed people. Something that I'd noticed universities trying to do since 2007, since I first learned about, I can go into more about this, but cognitive behavioral therapy, And I ran this idea by John, and we decided to write an article about it. And I think one of the reasons why the article took off was at least in part because we were noticing something a lot of other people were noticing right at the time. It was starting to become really intense. Since we were on the ground, we could see what the trends had been and where they were headed. And with the help of Jonathan, we could ground it not just in typical First Amendment law, which is where I come in, but also ground it in how in the argument that this is not just bad for free speech. It's bad not just, and it's not bad just for the mental health of the people they're opposing on campus, but it's even bad for the mental health of the activists. And what happened right after that, the thing that really made it clear that we had to go from writing a long article to writing a book, was that we thought maybe there'd be a little tiny increase in anxiety and depression among that cohort. It was a skyrocket. You ended up seeing, you know, unfortunately, over a short period of time, twice the number of suicides for college-age women. So apparently we were onto something, and it just ended up being much deeper than even we understood.
So you've got this quite extraordinary, quite narrowly defined in terms of the timing of it, almost a flicking of the switch from an acceptance that free speech was important to the idea that it can be harmful or hurtful, not just offensive and challenging. It seems to me that it's very hard to understand why it suddenly happened at that time. Why in 2014?
And that's the whole book, Coddling of the American Mind, which is, you know, now almost 2.5 years old, was to try to figure out, to do a social science detective story about what was so different about that generation coming in. It was incredibly interesting for us to do this research, to really go in deep. And so the causes that we pointed to that could create such a sharp discontinuity. One was social media. This was the first generation of students who were coming in large numbers who had cell phones in their pockets and social media in their pockets since they were little. And that was a major shift. The second one, which is also related to social media, is polarization, which is more of a gradual thing, but that had certainly sped up. So we talk about 6 causal threads. The other two are about parenting, which are a little bit more slow working, but the rise of paranoid parenting, which we attribute to a number of different causes. It's kind of funny because as America got safer, it's particularly the kind of parents who would send their kids to elite colleges got more paranoid about that. We talk about why universities, that's partially hyper-bureaucratization. And the one, before I get to the one where I'm starting to change my thinking on a little bit, the other one was lack of free play, that essentially there was an explosion towards the end of the 90s where we got to see like America getting rich and Silicon Valley blowing up. And I think that this really made parents think, oh my God, I got to send my kids to one of these Stanfords or Harvards or Princetons so they could be part of this exploding economy. That put a very high premium on elite education. And so I think that sort of sense of this ferocious competition also really sped up post-90s for the people who were having their kids after 95. Now, why I say 95 is because what we discovered was we were talking about a different generation, that essentially kids born 1995 or after, or actually 1996 or after 95, had a number of peculiar characteristics that made them very sharply distinct from the millennials, who often get lumped in the same category. But the category where I've changed my thinking on a little bit is the new ideas of social justice, which is everything from privilege to the medicalization of harm, to the idea that in order for things to be equitable, you have to have the same results rather than the same opportunities. And that one is a little bit hard to explain why it came up so hot and sudden, why it suddenly became so dominant. And that's at least in part social media, because these kind of rhetorical tactics that come out of social justice are very useful in argument. They give you ways of sort of trumping other people's arguments. Oh my God, Trump, I guess, is a word that I should probably stop using in that sense. But one thing that we tried to establish, and we couldn't quite do it in the book, but I'm thinking a lot about now, is that I think the anti-bullying movement that started after the suicide of Tyler Clementi in 2010. So this was a gay student. He was videotaped in an encounter with a man at Rutgers University by his clearly completely amoral roommate. And he was so humiliated by this, and this was so devastating to him, that he killed himself. He jumped off, I believe, the George Washington Bridge. And this brought what I think is actually much needed attention to the problem of bullying. It's a little bit of a weird fit, because what his antagonist did was illegal already. And he should have been punished for that, which he was. And it was college. But this brought focus on bullying in K-12, in addition to some really high profile, nasty cases of virtual mobs, mistreating girls, in some cases, who also committed suicide. So I think that one of the things that accounts for the sudden sharp change in ideology, increasingly, I think it's because it lines up when the anti-bullying education really got intense in high schools. So it started really more about in 2011. And that's when you start getting the students hitting colleges that have this very ingrained sense of a lot of the tenets of social justice.
Interesting that you have these enormous social programs. We're seeing them in Australia too, and probably right across the West, anti-bullying being one of them. This sort of really quite almost the state taking over the role of the parents in some ways, deciding that certain things should be, pushed, other things should be decried. But it's gone hand in hand with far from better results and more settled students and more harmonious communities to more disturbed communities. You touched on it. We're seeing it amongst our young people, record levels of anxiety and depression and self-harm. These programs are not working. And I wonder whether in part it's because we just aren't giving our children a decent narrative. They have no story in the first place and no means by which they are encouraged to see one another as of intrinsic value. In fact, the whole concept of identity politics seems to fly against what the state and its education departments, loosely defined, are trying to impose on our children.
Yeah, no, that's something that we really try to hit the mental health aspect of it hard, partially because I'm passionate about it, but partially because we sincerely believe that a lot of these ways of thinking, but also these ideologies, are devastating to mental health. So if you take kind of like how stressful social media is, even without ideology, it's very easy to get what is now called canceled, that essentially you say the wrong thing. Yeah. And next thing you know, they're demanding that you get kicked out of your high school, get punished, get kicked out of whatever university you're at, get kicked out of your job. So it creates a very tense situation, even without the hot ideology, just the sort of gotcha element of it, that all these dumb things that we would say or do when we were younger, or at least, in some cases, dumb things, that really went nowhere. Suddenly, if your bad joke goes viral, that could be it for you, or at least for at a particular institution, for example. And we really started to see that the social media turn nasty in like 2012, 2013. But add on to that kind of perilous kind of situation, you add on the ferocious competition to get into these elite schools and the sense that people are being left behind. But you add on top of it an ideology that's just as so bleak and hopeless as the current sort of form of social justice. Why wouldn't you expect people to be depressed? And I see it actually as a little bit of almost kind of cruelty. If you know that students are coming in with high rates of suicide, high rates of anxiety and depression, to tell them that they are part of an oppression matrix where practically all of them are oppressors, because really, if you look at the ideology, almost everybody is an oppressor, at least to someone.
Yeah. And also a victim.
Yes.
This is the interesting thing. Almost everybody in some way in their life has also been a victim.
Yeah. And that essentially the only things you can do about this are fixation on language, that they're admitting your guilt about becoming an ally. But ultimately, it's something you can't really fix. It's a very bleak outlook. And of course, when it comes to things you could be proud of, potentially anything from everything's problematized. And the idea that you should be shocked that people feel miserable in a circumstance where you're giving them such a bleak worldview, we really shouldn't be surprised.
And then you add to that climate change catastrophism. I'm not for a moment, please don't anyone hear me say I'm not saying it's important, but the catastrophism that's built up into such a sort of, oh, the children understand how serious it is, we're all going to die, what's wrong with the adults? We see a lot of that in Australia. And the children we know now, many of them feel, well, I'm going to die anyway. And even the worst predictions from the international experts hardly support that thesis. More difficult, challenging, worrying, but we kill hope. We kill hope.
Yeah, and it sounds like an issue that we both take seriously. And one thing that I find frustrating about it is that the idea of like, so what can we do? I'm big on nuclear power, for example. I'm big on trying to get fusion to work. There are actually solutions to this. But I just finished a good book by Martin Gurry. We come from different political standpoints. But he makes the point that globally, social media, the fifth wave, really is only capable, at least at this point, of negation. It's only capable of sort of tearing things down. And if you look at that from the point of view of 2011, a lot more stuff starts to make sense. And that's one of the reasons why real issues like global warming, the idea that if you can only tear things down, then when people offer positive solutions, that gets torn down too. And what are you left with? Just a constant state of crisis.
Yeah. It's a trite thing to say, but it seems to me that one of the terrible things we've done, and I'm a mid-baby boomer, is to really make our children the mincemeat in our culture wars. Mm-hmm. You said a very interesting thing in a discussion with Brett Weinstein, just sort of summarizing this. You actually said something to the effect that inflicting woke ideology on students who are already well known to be experiencing high levels of depression and anxiety is actually incredibly irresponsible, which I think is what I'm saying as well. But do you have any further observations to make there? It seems to me that one of the really noticeable aspects of postmodernism as in its latest form, critical theory, is that there's an assumption, particularly in the West, that everything that's been done before us has been wrong, that we're never capable of making progress. And presumably that's because critical theorists would argue that the system's so rotten, you can never concede it's done anything right, because that would say, well, it's not completely rotten. It may be possible that it can be redeemed, and they don't want that avenue open to young people, which adds to the despair. They're left feeling that the system is so hopeless, we've got to find something else, but how could you ever find something better?
Yeah. Well, and what you're getting at is inherent in our three great untruths in the book. But essentially, what we argue in the book is that it's as if we're teaching a generation of students and of citizens very dysfunctional lessons that when said aloud, you'd be like, well, that sounds ridiculous. And one of them is, your feelings are always right, which is the one that has the most sort of attractiveness, because it sounds initially, if you don't really think about it, not that bad. But it is bad, because one of the things that you learn from, dealing with anxiety and depression is how to, talk back to your feelings and how to make them not the boss of you. So that's probably the most attractive one. What doesn't kill you makes you weaker is another thing that we talk about as being a great untruth. This idea that telling students that, oh, by the way, the world is filled with things that will permanently harm you. And they could also just be ideas or speech, and they may not harm you, but they could harm these people over here forever. And there's nothing that can be done about it. And of course, that ignores a lot of phenomena like post-traumatic growth, which is something that gets discussed, that a lot of people actually get through traumatic events with a sense of competence, a sense of power, but it completely leaves that out. And then the last one, that the anti-bullying, message, I think actually really turned the temperature way up, but also American political polarization, of course, did too, is that life is a battle between good people and evil people. And I think this speaks to something like deep in our hearts that want that battle, that want that good versus evil battle. But of course, when you look at the world that way, that's also pretty bleak. And it means that, and when you look at all the rules that you have, when it comes to social justice, when it comes to sort of campus ideology, that means your brother is the enemy. That means your dad might be the enemy. That might mean your best friend's suddenly the enemy. So it's incredibly sad. But if I were to add one, like an underlying untruth, one of the things I've been playing with is the idea that the truth is easily known and largely known, because social justice has this. When I talk about social justice, I am largely talking about the way it's described by Helen Pluckrose, in her book. Cynical Theories, which even though I've heard critiques of it, I've never heard that it's substantively incorrect on any of this stuff. And this kind of very deep theory of everything that really, frankly, has no basis in research, but nonetheless is obsession with language is all that matters. Everything's in decline. It's all about power and privilege. It's really, honestly, like not a particularly sophisticated theory. It is an oversimplification of everything about humanity, which people from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s came up with because they thought, what, that was the lowest point of human history? So the idea that some of these postmodernist theorists looked at American society in the 50s, 60s, and 70s and said, this is the absolute nadir of human civilization, and we have to bash materialism, and we have to get at the underlying evil within our society. It just seems strange for any student of history to really think of, like, don't you think maybe 100 years before that or 200 years before that was a worse time than we currently live in? So we have people living in times that our grandparents would have been blown away by the convenience and luxury that we enjoy. But we also have convinced ourselves it's the worst possible time to be alive.
It is extraordinary. And the other thing there's so many things we could talk about there. But the other thing that seems so bleak about it is that this idea that if life's a battle between good people and bad people, then you have to set yourself up as a good person. You're hardly going to set yourself up as part of the problem. And before you know it, you're in territory where you lack self-awareness and any sort of awareness of your own failings. And far from helping people's mental health, that seems to damage it. Worse than that, perhaps, is that you lose the capacity for genuine identification with other people as opposed to concocted identity in an empathy age, empathy rather in an empathy age. And you become very unforgiving, very intolerant. Tolerance is meant to be, one of the great values of the age. But it strikes me that we could hardly be less tolerant. That critical theory is a doctrine of unbelievable intolerance, where there's almost no place, if there's any, for forgiveness, unless you do a complete groveling mea culpa and fall completely in line. And of course, there's very little prospect of forgiveness, forgetting and just moving on. It's always capable to bring things up against people in an age when everything's recorded against you.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. It teaches a kind of dismissiveness over most of the population of the planet, while at the same time talking about things like, tolerance and compassion and inclusivity, it gives you sort of a cartoon version of what your fellow human beings are like. And when you look at some of the recent studies of empathy among younger people, a lot of them, at least the ones that I've seen, seem to indicate that empathy has actually gone down, which is surprising when you explain to the students, when you explain this to them, like, well, but we're trying to be more inclusive than ever. I'm like, yes, but what do you actually think about your literal neighbor now? What do you think about your uncle or aunt that gets mouthy at Thanksgiving? And it tends to be this very oversimplified narrative of them being evil and you being maybe good. And of course, like when you get deep into the ideology, it is a state where the most you could ever hope to be is maybe good-ish.
Yeah. Well, so to change gears a bit, if I could, and well, it'll involve these very themes again, but to come to FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, and you're its president, can you tell us a bit about FIRE? And then I'd love to move on to your role as a First Amendment scholar, but FIRE first.
Oh, delighted to. So FIRE was founded in 1999 when I was just finishing up law school. And when I graduated, I was the unusual law student who wanted to go into First Amendment law specifically. And of course, everyone was saying there's no jobs in that, you know, kind of like, what? Why are you hyper specializing in this weird thing that almost nobody works in? But I, you know, took a risk and I didn't go to the law firm route. And FIRE found me because partially I'd cultivated the reputation as being the First Amendment guy. And so I started there in 2001, right after 9/11. And I've dealt with cases all over the political map, every kind of speech. But the main thing that kind of surprised me starting in 2001 was, one, already it was really easy to get in trouble for what you said on campus. But two, a lot of what would get you in trouble on campus was stuff that people off campus, at least back then, wouldn't even bat an eye at. It was so remarkably tame by the standards of, say, Comedy Central, for example, that would get what could get you in trouble on campus. So I've now been doing this. FIRE's just turned 20 last year. And it's been a heck of a ride. And of course, you know, I wrote a book called Unlearning Liberty, which came out in 2012, talking about my first 12 years defending free speech on campus. And it is a long or maybe short, strange trip.
Well, particularly here in this country, people might know so much about the First Amendment. There's an interesting historical aspect to it, of course, because, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, after the War of Independence and then the setting up of the federated states, if you like, coming together as the new republic, there were huge tensions. It's not unusual for there to be very deep divisions in American society. In some ways, as a former practitioner of politics, that can be a very good thing as long as there's basic respect for the other person and a willingness to negotiate. So you had the anti-federalists lining up against those who felt that America needed to, you know, set up what we now call America, I suppose you'd say. And the anti-federalists needed some assurance that this new power center would not take away individual rights, as I understand it. And that stood behind the development of the First Amendment way back in, what, the 1780s, 1790s? Can you just give us a feel for it? Because history is important.
Oh, yeah. No. It's kind of sad because when you look at how on campus and in high schools American history is taught, it's become, unfortunately, extremely negative. When I think, you know, if you're a constitutional lawyer, you're proud of something about the United States. And for a lot of Americans, what we're proud of is our Constitution. And we should be proud of our Constitution. To a large degree, the lessons of the horrible religious wars of Europe were burned into the brains of our founders, thankfully. And a lot of those problems that you saw in the old country in Europe, you know, they came across to the U.S. as well, but in an interesting form. And partially when people are so concerned with everything in terms of identity politics, in terms of race, not knowing that much about American history, can look at the colonial period and say, oh, well, it's all white people. It's like, yes, there are white people whose grandparents, parents, maybe even they fought in religious wars back in Europe, were at each other's throats in the North. And then you had slave owning merchants in the South. It was a weird cacophony of dissimilar people who, in some cases, if you had them in the same room together, would hate each other's guts. So it wasn't as if peaceful, like, you know, lilies and flowers for everybody. And people really kind of miss the religious part of it too, because, you know, the idea that it takes a lot of genuine commitment to tolerance to really be like, listen, I think your idea is going to send you and your family to hell. But at the same time, I will be a citizen with you, and we will go and we will hear each other out and all that kind of stuff. So the First Amendment, you know, sometimes there's a tendency among historians to refer to the French Revolution as the radical revolution and the American Revolution as the conservative revolution. And to a degree, that's justified. I mean, the French Revolution went entirely off the rails in unfortunately spectacular ways. But I do bristle a little bit at people talking about the American Revolution as being conservative, because if you look at the 17 in the old sense, not in the political sense, conservative in the sense of being like not radical. But if you look at the First Amendment, you know, it protects freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom to petition your government, freedom to assemble. And a lot of times they call it the religion clause, which I don't like. It's two separate things. One is you have the freedom to exercise your religion as you see fit. And most arguably, as importantly, that the state cannot impose a religion or cannot even establish its own religion. And we take this for granted now, but think about the world that the founding fathers were coming from. They were saying, these are now going to be things that we no longer spill blood over. We're not going to spill blood over opinion, over press, over assembly, over religion, or your freedom from religion. This is a radical, positive step in human history, and it's embodied in the First Amendment. And it's so radical that many of us have to choose what clause of the First Amendment we defend. So I'm not as well versed in the religion aspect, but the free speech aspect of it has been so crucial to the development of every certainly in the 20th century. It's why we were able to have a civil rights movement and a gay rights movement and a women's rights movement. It was and why did that take so long? It's partially, unfortunately, because it wasn't until 1925 that the Supreme Court started taking seriously the First Amendment had real implications for the states themselves through the 14th Amendment, which came after the Civil War. It's a little bit complicated, but when you look at what free speech has done, I have to go and when I speak on campus, and I always really forgive me for talking a little bit longer on this. This is a really important point that people seem to miss, because the way I feel like a generation is being miseducated about it. Wealth and power have always been protected in human society. What are they protected by? They've been protected by wealth and power. Wealth and power protects itself. And so that's all of human history. Once you start having democracy, then 51% protects you as well. So we now have a state where the wealthy and powerful are still protected. The majority now have power too. But what we were recognizing in the First Amendment and in the Bill of Rights was that we didn't want to live in a country where every 4 years or every year, depending on like whether it's a Congress or president to be more important, that the minority gets completely beaten up and jailed and put away by the majority. So freedom of speech, First Amendment only exists to protect minority points of view and minority religions. All that kind of stuff. But you have a generation of people who have been educated in an environment where the political the political leaning is so lopsided in the other direction. They've actually been miseducated to believe that free speech is about tyranny. It's about it's about the rule of the majority. It's like, no, it's the exact opposite. And the only reason why this generation can't see it is because universities will not admit, to be frank, their own privilege.
Yeah. I get that precisely. I think it's an incredibly important point. Free speech is there to protect the little people, not the privileged and the powerful. And this is one of the great problems I think we have. In an age like ours, the problem is that the people who have the cultural heft don't think it's an issue because they're not feeling constrained. They're patting one another on the back saying, we're right. We've got the power. To go back to the framing of that constitution, I take your point that leaving behind the ugliness of much of what had happened in Europe was probably very much in the minds of the framers of the Constitution. And you think of Alexander Hamilton in particular, worried about mob rule. How do we restrain mob rule? But I just test a thesis with you. I've always thought, though, that the essential, I suppose you'd say Christian concept that each individual has worth and dignity but is fallible, was also very prominent in their thinking. You see, this is the counter to the problem of life is a battle between good people and bad people. There was a recognition that no one had a monopoly on either. And that seems to me to be one of the things that we are losing, that was unique to the Judeo-Christian influenced West, this unique understanding that every individual has worth and dignity, but at the same time is fallible. As one American put it, Americans are so good we had to give ourselves the vote. Americans are so bad we had to give ourselves the vote. It captures that dual aspect. So this is important to understand as our society unravels, and we're confronted now by the rise again of communism, where, of course, the good people are the people who are in power. They determine what's right and wrong, and everybody else falls into line. It's a very different and very dangerous doctrine, and should force us surely to re-examine our own roots, because we find their massive wisdom and insight bought at the expense of great learning, great study, but also a proper reading of history.
Yeah. Well, I talk about this a lot. I mean, clearly my last name is Russian. My great-great-grandfather was a serf. We would have been labeled kulaks because we were peasants who made good, owned land, were doing actually quite well at the time of the First World War. So I have a lot of family experience with the issue of communism versus liberalism, small liberalism. And this is the way I've ended up having to explain it to people who feel warm and fuzzy about that, which is amazing to actually have to deal with as an adult. But the founders of the U.S. created a system that will still work even if people were miserable jerks. Like they wanted to create a system that could deal pretty effectively with human flaws. So that's one of the reasons why they wanted democracy, but they didn't want mob rule. They wanted power to be divided because of bias. All of these things that a lot of times when you talk to people on college campuses, they think we just came up with these ideas. It's like, no, the founding fathers were incredibly clever in the ways that they divided up power and created checks and balances because of people could be both wonderful and terrible. And so there's an optimism and a little bit of realism. I even hesitate to call it cynicism about human nature that's inherent in our constitutional system. Meanwhile, communism was predicated on the idea that people could be angels, that at least the model citizen they'd subject themselves, they'd give themselves over to the morality of the state and become sort of the perfect proletariat. And the problem with that is that if you assume people are angels, it actually creates a situation in which there's tremendous incentive to be evil, to actually be the one who doesn't have to play by the rules. And so it wasn't a coincidence that you saw this incredibly cynical situation going on. Because if someone, and I don't think it was a coincidence you had people like Stalin, sociopaths, who were essentially like, well, you know, if you guys are all bound by all these like little rules, I don't have to be. And so I think it created, for generations of Russians, a really messed up sense of morality. Meanwhile, they thought over here in the U.S. it was just all evil capitalism and all stabbing each other in the back. But it actually turns out that with a good system of laws, with a good system of checks and balances, with a system of market-friendly economies where people are actually trying to have transactions with each other, it actually encourages a sense of like, oh, actually, it's on me to be trustworthy, it's on my to be diligent, to be all of these kind of things that currently don't get enough sort of credit and understanding, like the fostering of trust, for example, how essential the fostering of trust it has been in American commercial success, for example, or for that is something that's badly underappreciated.
Yeah, and I understand, and I strongly concur with what you're saying. Indeed, I wonder how many people today could write with the depth of experience and insight and the eloquence. And I don't claim to have read anything like all of them, but I've read snippets of them, of the so-called Federalist Papers, many of them written by Alexander Hamilton. They are amazing. And I think we are incredibly smug when we think, oh, it all just happened, and now I can be an activist and get my way and not worry about actually being a positive contributor to society. I'll use democracy without understanding what democracy is. But to move on, because... I'll talk too much, and I really want to capture your thoughts. You said something very interesting about you believe that universities is an attractive idea to me, ought to be sort of like laboratories for free speech, but they, you know, they're not being. And can I ask you why, philosophically, just to really drill into this, why should people care about free speech? And do you think there's anything that, you know, where should we draw the limits? Should there be limits, and where should we draw them?
I have a slightly different philosophy on free speech than most people. And mine is probably one of the more expansive theories that you're going to run into. So the marketplace of ideas is sort of the dominant metaphor in First Amendment law. That basically, and this is Oliver Wendell Holmes, you know, great jurist, great genius, you know, who we were very lucky to have on the Supreme Court and became one of the first champions of freedom of speech. Kind of an unlikely choice to be champion of freedom of speech. And at first, actually, he was very skeptical of it. And it was him and Louis Brandeis who eventually really radicalized the First Amendment and made it powerful. But he, his argument was that essentially, and him and Brandeis's, was that you wanted a marketplace of ideas where essentially things can battle out for dominance, and presumably not necessarily the best would win, but some of the bad ideas would fail. They didn't have any kind of hyper optimism about the idea that good ideas will always succeed, but truth doesn't have a standing a fighting chance when you can't even say it, basically. Mm-hmm. But I go a step further. I think that the value of freedom of speech is very simple, but very essential to any society. It's knowing what people really think, period. And I don't just believe that from a point of view of democracy. And that's where marketplace of ideas makes the most sense. The marketplace of ideas metaphor makes most sense in two different places, democracy and in scholarship. In the idea of battling out ideas, that's about the battle of ideas. But it's only about this kind of small piece of the pie. Most of freedom of expression is simply letting people be themselves and knowing what makes them tick and knowing what they really think. And this is important from a democratic standpoint shortly, because and this is important from a scientific standpoint, because this is the whole humanist project. It's the project of human knowledge. It's to know what the world's actually like. And you know nothing about what the world is actually like if you don't know how people actually tick and what they really think. And therefore, I think I have a very expansive view of freedom of speech. And this includes things like, you know, I don't think people should be going to jail for conspiracy theories. Now, if they do something that crosses a line into conspiracy, conspiracy to commit a crime, all that kind of stuff, our law actually handles that really quite well. But the fact that someone believes in a conspiracy theory is not just it's a worthwhile thing to know. And currently, right now, we have this QAnon phenomena in the U.S. and it's much more, it's wild conspiracy theory. It actually led to someone shooting up a pizza bar that people like to go to in Washington, D.C. It's like one Cosmos. It's like one of our favorite places. And it's like, wow, you actually thought there was a child sex ring in the basement? Now, of course, anything that person did towards going and shooting up and all that kind of stuff, there are multiple illegal steps before that actually happened. But it's really important to know that if you have these ideas in society, that people can actually talk about them. Because when you get people just talking to other people who already agree with them, it has a very predictable social science effect. It causes people to be more radical in the position, in the conspiracy in some cases, but in the belief that they were. They get a sense of tribalism. They get more arguments on their side, and it leads to a polarization spiral. So even conspiracy theories, not only do I think that they are they should be protected, I think that they're worthy of study. And I think that, for example, like the Elders of the Protocols of Zion, horrifying idea that there was a Jewish conspiracy to dominate the world that came out in the teens or 1920s. But you have to study that because you have to understand what actually happened in the world. You have to be able to know what the world actually looks like. So my view overall on free speech is extremely expansive, but at the same time, I also, and this is where I'm a bad American, is that I show up in other countries and I say, listen, I know I'm supposed to say, well, this is our system. It shouldn't be your system. I throw that out the window. I'm like, listen, I think that the American First Amendment jurisprudence has been some of the best thought out meditations on how you have free speech in the real world. as someone actually in charge. And that I think that those exceptions that we created in First Amendment law make a lot of coherent sense. Not necessarily perfectly in all of them, but for example, that's why incitement is not protected in the United States. But it can't just be, hey, I think we should overthrow the government. It has to be a situation where you're actually about to go and do said behavior. Libel is not protected, for example, which is claiming falsely, and particularly when it comes to public figures, knowing something's not true and saying this person's committed some heinous act, like pedophilia is one of the examples that's given, that's not protected. We do have what I think are just in line with human nature, ability to restrict kids' exposure to sexual content, for example. First Amendment lawyers have trouble with that, but I think that in the psychological battle between parents and the First Amendment, that if you can't actually take any steps to sort of keep your kids from seeing porn, that's going to lose. So I think we're very pragmatic on that. We have things like time, place, and manner restrictions that essentially, it's perfectly reasonable to stop someone on the basis of their decibel level from having a concert, in Central Park at 4 o'clock in the morning. So it's a very coherent body of law. But what makes it different from other countries is one of the main things that makes it different is the bedrock principle. And the bedrock principle, it comes from a case about burning American flags. And it's simply that you can't ban something just because it's offensive.
Understood. Well, that brings us to universities. After a 2007 study, I think, said that a lot of the codes in American universities in relation to free speech were laughably unconstitutional. In fact, I think you said most of them, if not three quarters of them. What were some of the worst examples of violations of free speech protection on campus? And I must say, I was amazed to hear that some of them have free speech zones on campuses. What are they?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote a whole book on the worst violations from that point in my career. And free speech zones are one of the ones that just really particularly drive me nuts. And these keep on cropping their head up, and they're taking advantage of this time, place, and manner restriction idea, where essentially they say, this campus loves free speech so much, we're going to set aside one lone gazebo on campus. This was really the case at Texas Tech University, and Texas Tech University is one of the biggest universities physically in the whole country. They have 28,000 students, and they were trying to tell people that you got one 20-foot wide gazebo to exercise your free speech, which included handing out pamphlets, handing out magazines. And that was laughably unconstitutional. And we challenged that with the help of a Christian litigation group, and it was defeated. But I mean, it's amazing. Like I see a case right now that we see on the United States where it's a professor who had an exam question that included a reference to racial epithets, and it was B blank and N blank, and one is for a derogatory, and then he had parentheses. One is a derogatory term for women, and another one is a derogatory term for African Americans. This is at law school, where you're taking every lawyer is required to take crim law. Crim law is grisly. It's nonstop horror show of like really unlikely cases because we have a common law. Country, torts, is grisly as well. And the idea that you would actually even have to, excise out epithets because it somehow is no longer understood that you can talk about something without calling somebody something, which is something, a basic idea of education is that you can examine something as adults from the outside. But in this case, the professor even X'd it out. But apparently making students think about those words was considered offensive enough that he's suspended. And this is University of Illinois at Champaign, a major university in the U.S. And at a law school. And you have to wonder, it's like, how are these people going to practice law if they can't even be reminded of some of the things that actually will happen, some of the horrible things that people will say in law practice or for the interesting things that people will study?
Students coming out of this environment, I mean, I heard a man I respect hugely recently say that, oh, yes, but they get out into the real world, have to start finding a job, pay taxes. They all come to their senses. I'm beginning to think that that's very optimistic indeed. that these people who are coming out of our universities, I don't want to sound derogatory about them. I think we need to accept a huge part of the responsibility for what's happened as older Westerners. But I suspect they are now starting to shape the world in ways that is quite unrealistic and quite frightening, that they're not going to lead us into some sort of new nirvana. And I think particularly of the way in which many young people, I'm sure well-meaning, joined the Black Lives Matter movement without understanding what Black Lives Matter in particular really is, or without having a real understanding, here's the important point that I raised earlier, of the progress that has actually been made. There's this idea that somehow, some people might say, we've made tremendous progress on many of these issues. We're getting to a much better place, but all of a sudden we decide we're complete and absolute failures, and we go accelerate harder than ever down the road of self-condemnation. So young people are starting to shape, or these views are starting to shape our society in ways which will transform it and end up costing us our freedoms.
Well, when it comes to Black Lives Matter, you know, people get the sentence confused with the organization, and absolutely. And of course, Black Lives Matter. And I'm a civil liberties lawyer. So do I believe that American policing needs reform? Absolutely. The kind of things that we saw happening with George Floyd, you know, for example, happening across the country, a lot of these are incidents of real police abuses. One of the things that when you start things like the George Floyd incident, you know, got broadcast all over the country, there was a moment when you had near unanimity in the U.S. for police reform. And there are specific things we could have done, you know, limiting or eliminating the kind of liability protections police have. You could have body cameras. You could have review boards. There's lots of different ways you could address the disproportionate power of police unions. There were specific things we could have and should have done during that time. But unfortunately, the ideology that comes off campus, it doesn't, like I said, it doesn't really seem to want a solution. It's about this eternal process of guilt and shame, as if that will have some positive effect, and really policing your language as well will actually create a positive effect without engaging the political process. It's a theory of social change that seems to be really just grounded in feeling differently, which won't actually do it, won't actually fix the problem. And one of these things that you see with this generation that we first were concerned about when they were hitting campus, as they're hitting the workplace, is that ordinary interpersonal conflict at some of these workplaces has turned into matters for human resources, HR. And we saw this coming, and Height and I were being told by employers that they were being hit with a wave of recent graduates from elite colleges who were kind of ungovernable, that essentially small conflicts, things that would have been not even come across HR's desk previously, were things that required staff meetings and attention away oftentimes from the good work of the organization itself. So I think that what we've done, unfortunately, is we've taught at least a sizable percentage of the people graduating from elite colleges beliefs that are dysfunctional for their mental health, but also ones that are dysfunctional for corporations. And you saw this in act, for example, at the New York Times, James Bennett, who was brought to the New York Times specifically to make sure that the New York Times was no longer in an echo chamber of just sort of elite liberal opinion. That's why he was brought to the New York Times. That's why he added Barry Weiss to the writers at the New York Times, because the New York Times at least had a moment of self-reflection in 2016 where they said, oh my God, like we didn't see the Trump thing coming. We need to get better in touch. Well, after doing his job pretty well, and James Bennett brought in all sorts of interesting opinions over that time, he got people who were particularly the recent graduates really hated his guts for it, and particularly for bringing someone like a mildly right of center person like Barry Weiss. Somehow that was offensive to a number of people at the Times. And when James Bennett published a piece from a senator, a sitting senator, saying that maybe we should bring in the National Guard to deal with violence from the riots that were happening over the last year, something I oppose, by the way, to be very clear. When they published that, and this was the opinion of 53% of the population of the country, 53%. So this wasn't a minority point of view. This was a senator saying it, and it was the opinion of the president of the United States. He was told that he was putting the lives of reporters of color in danger, an argumentation tactic that is very much like an elite college argumentation tactic. And he was forced to resign. Only about a month later, Barry Weiss resigned as well. And this is just one example of a very public sort of colonization of major corporations by this point of view that doesn't really accept different points of view. That's very, very conformist, even though they like to think of it as being, you know, maybe, I don't know what they like to think of it as, but it's very strict. And it's happening at corporations all over the country. And some corporations probably already suffered from this. And I think it's going to bring some major ones down.
Where do you think the Biden administration will go on freedom of speech? And in particular, what attitude will they take towards the Facebooks and the Twitters, the platforms of this world that seem now to be determined to play a role in what we can and can't hear, and therefore what we can and can't think?
Yeah. Well, I'm concerned about the incoming administration. Now, I make no bones about it. I'm a Democrat. I voted for Biden. And I voted for him knowing that he was going to come in and maybe turn the Department of Education back into the one that we'd been battling during the Obama administration. And all things being equal, I decided, you know, that essentially we can convince them to not go back to the bad practices from the Department of Education previously. Now, you hear Obama talk about free speech, and you talk about listening across lines of difference. He's incredible. He's really, really good on this stuff. And I hope that some of that thinking has brushed off on Biden. What I suspect is going to happen is we're going to find ourselves banging heads a lot with the Department of Education again. And when it comes to what's going to happen to social media, at this point, I don't know. I honestly don't know what's going to happen. I think that the Trump administration had a very bad idea in trying to get rid of Section 230. I think that if Section 230 got repealed, and that's liability protection for not just for social media, but for internet service providers of all kinds. If 230 got repealed, some of the people who would suffer the most, ironically, would be Trump supporters. It would mean that internet service providers would suddenly not want to put material that they could get them sued up there. And once you got corporations playing cautious, it's going to be every dissenting opinion is going to be kicked off. So I think that some of the ideas of how to manage social media were really not good in the previous administration. But I don't know what they're going to look like in the Biden administration. So right now, fingers crossed that it won't be worse than getting rid of 230.
Right. Well, you've been very generous with your time. I wonder if you can wrap up. It's very tempting to say, to hear people expressing, I don't know where we're going to end up with these trend lines, but it doesn't look like it's going to end well. I'm afraid I am of a slightly different view. I think we're in the mess, but that probably preempts the question that I wanted to put to you. If you think in recent years, say the last 5 years in particular, of the things that have shaped America, technology and social media, what we might loosely call Trumpism, and I've never seen Trump as so much the problem as the result of a divided and polarized America where too many people felt shut out, but you may have a different view on that. Wokeness and the whole sort of critical theory movement as a practical manifestation of postmodernism, and COVID. Where do you think America's at now? And do you think America can put this behind? Sometimes the darkest is just before the dawn, or is it going to be just too much to sort of reconstruct a free and open and global leader? Because that's what America's been, and champion of liberal democratic principles and ways of living.
I'm somewhat optimistic about the fate of free speech for a very simple reason. Free speech works really well. It tells you what problems you have. It gives you solutions. It tells you, I mean, even just the free flow of information, which is my overall take on the value of free speech. I call it the pure informational value of free speech. It just works really well. So for the long term, I think that a lot of these small L liberal institutions will succeed because they're smart and they're effective. Over the next couple of years, I mean, COVID was definitely one of those things that is like a slap in the face to remember the contingency of history, that essentially things can go very wrong very quickly for things that you didn't necessarily, that you might have foreseen, but end up being many times worse than you think. It was, at the same time, you know, America pulled for a moderate candidate, a comparatively moderate compared to the rest of the field. Is there a possibility of healing during this time in the post-COVID era? I hope so. I am afraid that, just like you said, that we're in the middle of something that is, frankly, not just an American shift, it's a global shift. And the negation theory that essentially social media can only destroy, it can't really build up, I think we're still in that. And I think that addressing that is going to require, you know, new cultural norms about arguing that actually look a lot like the old cultural norms about arguing, a more involved population when it comes to actual decision making. And that could potentially be very positive. Negation, you know, scientific method to a large degree is about tearing things down so you can build them back up. So maybe there's a bright side on the other end of this. Where do I think we end up? I'm hopeful. You know, I'm hopeful for a resuscitation of small L liberalism, partially because it's a path for human fulfillment and advancement and society. But are we at the turning point where that's going to start to come back? I don't know.
Well, that's a tremendous point to wind up and to say thank you very, very much. I think Helen Pluckrose and James Lindsay make a very interesting point that classic democratic liberalism, as we've known it for so long, enables people from left of centre and right of centre to find a platform where they can hammer out their differences, come up with a consensus, and have that consensus owned. I'm putting words into their mouth, but this is the way I see it, that the maximum number of people can own. And no one has come up with a better model, no one. And so surely, given the stark alternatives that are now on offer and so easy to see in our own societies, but also globally, there'll be enough people of good sense and goodwill to move back. And I salute you, sir, if I can use an old English expression, for the vigorous and courageous role that people like you, and you in particular, are playing in the clarion call, issuing a clarion call for a return to good, sound, sensible principles that have served us so well in the past.
Thank you. No, I really appreciate that. And liberalism is one of the great inventions of human history, and free speech is one of the greatest inventions of human history. And I hope we don't throw it away because we're scared or anxious.
Thank you for watching this episode. We appreciate your support. If you value vital conversations like this one, be sure to subscribe to the channel there and also click the notification bell to stay up to date with new releases.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Christians Engaging Culture. Make sure you visit the CEC website, where we have included many more helpful resources. You can find that at cec.stthomas.org.au. That's cec.st-thomas.org.au. Until next time, remember what C.S. Lewis said: I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else.